The Holy Gospel according to St. Mark, chapter 16. Glory to you, O Lord. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go and anoint Jesus' body. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They had been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?" When they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He is not here. Look, there is the place they laid him. But go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. The Gospel of the Lord. Praise to you, O Christ. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable to you, O Lord, our Rock and our Redeemer. Before we get on with today, I want to ask a question. What in heaven's name happened on Friday? Now, I'm not talking about just what happened. We probably, all of us in kind of broad strokes, know what did happen. He was betrayed by one of his own. He was arrested by emissaries of his enemies. He was abandoned by all of his own, with another of his own later cursing out loud as he outright denied that he even had any idea who Jesus even was. He was then given a sham of a hearing in religious courts, whose leaders, not having the authority to sentence him to death, then orchestrated a mob-crazed hearing before the one who did have such authority, the Roman governor Pontius Pilate, who apparently didn't want to have him killed, but came to realize the political expedience of okaying it nevertheless. At which point, in what I think I perceive to be a possible power play to make the statement that would counter the narrative that might be going around, and that was that in fact he had caved before the religious leaders and the crowd. And to counter that impression, he ordered him not just to be killed, but to suffer like hell in the course of dying. And so his bare back was whipped 39 times with what was called a flogging whip that typically had things like broken shards of pottery and metal hooks woven into its leather strands, with the professional goon who was doing the whipping having learned to maximize the effect by not just striking him, but pulling the strands across his back after each time he did, ripping his skin open. Then the heavy crossbeam of a cross was laid on that brutalized back for him to carry to the place where he'd be nailed to it. He fell at least once doing so, his knees grinding into the pavement and the cross beam grinding into his back's shredded skin. When they did get to where they were going, they did nail him to it, and upon that cross he did suffer quite literally like hell until 6 hours later, at 3 p.m, he died. Back to my question, what in heaven's name happened in all of that? What in heaven's name happened on Friday? In 2,000 years of seeking to answer that question, various of what are called atonement theories have sought to explain it in various ways, that what in heaven's name happened was that God apparently needed someone to hate so that God could then love you. Or God needed someone to suffer like hell so God could then give heaven to you. Or God needed someone to be righteously, brutally punished for sin, or else God couldn't forgive the sins of you. These various atonement theories all have in common the belief that Jesus went through all that he went through because it was the will of God. Which I've come to believe is actually absolutely true, even as it is simultaneously absolute nonsense. The will of God was not for Jesus to be killed, but be listened to and followed as he modeled and taught that there's a better way to be truly human than the way people were going about it then and the way people are still going about it now. The will of God was not for Jesus to be hated or to hate anybody, but rather to model and make known that God is love and that the truest way to be truly human is to love, and that love that is true is not love that is love just for those who love you or those who are like you or those whom you like. So if that's the case, what in heaven's name happened on Friday? Well, what happened, and I think this is where we can talk about the work of the will of God in the midst of it all. What happened is that the world voted no to him and to love. And Jesus, suffering absolutely, literally, like hell, loved anyway. Forgiving those who did what they did to him and asking God to do the same. Note to self, if you're still convinced that his brutal death in itself was the will of God, there would be no need for God to forgive those who were doing the will of God, right? The will of God was not that he was hated. The will of God was that not even hate this hateful could make him hate back. The will of God was not his death. The will of God is that he would love the world and love you to death. As the will of God, too. Well, let's talk. Let's talk now not about that Friday, but about that Sunday. That Sunday, just shy of 2,000 years ago now, when those who had loved him and had been loved by him now huddled, some in groups, some alone, but all of them in a prison of aching grief and traumatized fear. The unholy alliance of church and state, having done all that it did do brutally to preach its sermon, proclaiming its gospel truth, its gospel being. Don't be pinning your hopes and your hearts to the power of love. Pin your hopes and your hearts and your fears too to the power of the powerful who didn't get where they are by loving, but by taking no prisoners. Because love, sure as hell, isn't how the real world works. Which my news feeds tell me every single day is probably true. Love apparently isn't how the real world works. Just those same news feeds every day also beg a question. Is the real world actually working? Back to that Sunday, back to this Sunday, 2,000 years ago, where in the Gospel of Mark's telling, having the evening before, just after sunset when the Sabbath ended, having brought then embalming spices, early on that Sunday, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome set out for the tombs so they would anoint his body. And on the way, they had been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?" And when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe, sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, do not be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He is not here. Look, there is the place they laid him. But go tell Peter and his disciples that he's going ahead of you to Galilee, and there you will see him, just as he told you. So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Some of you know this, some of you don't. I'm talking about the fact that the women ran from the tomb terrified and said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. That is not just where our gospel reading for this morning ends. That of all places, they said the women ran from the tomb terrified and said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. That is how Mark's entire original gospel actually ends. Now, you might want to fact check me on that. If you do, I'll tell you by way of full disclosure. If you look in your gospels, you will see some more verses after that one, but there's not a scholar I respect who, for all kinds of reasons, who actually thinks that Mark actually wrote those following verses. They were rather written later, added by someone later, by somebody else who presumably said to themselves, they ran from the tomb, terrified and said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. That's no way to run a resurrection. Who the heck ends a story like that? Apparently Mark does. And of course, we also have Matthew and Luke and John as well. And from them, we learn that the women ultimately didn't remain silent. They told people because, well, by way of one example, because here we are, word got out. So obviously, of course, fear and silence aren't where the story ends. But fear and silence were where the story first went. And fear and silence, too, were where Mark's gospel anyway does end, which leaves it feeling to many, including as some writer a few years later, feeling kind of unresolved, unfinished, and so that writer finished it. It's just that that is where Mark finished. Which over the years is a detail I've kind of come to decide that I actually kind of like. For among other reasons, because it sounds authentic to me. Even more so in recent years, where in this nation and this world, and probably in more than a few of our lives, even though Easter has come and has now today come again, so many of us have, there are so many as yet still unresolved and often frightening tensions remaining politically, culturally, racially, religiously, spiritually, economically, militarily, environmentally, globally. Mark's is the gospel that these recent years feel so authentic to me, because Mark doesn't leave us after Easter with all tensions and fears resolved as the disciples or the women or anyone lay their eyes upon the risen Jesus. Mark's is the gospel, rather, that ends with a young preacher's graveside promise, reminding them of Jesus' own thrice-stated promise that one day they will see him again, risen from the dead. And the women then, representing all who hear the promise then and now, are confused, scared even, because they don't know what to make of either the promise or the nothing in the tomb that is all they can see, with the only thing they know for sure being that they don't see Jesus. Which is why I like Mark's gospel. For it more clearly than any of them reminds us that Jesus, even risen for now, doesn't dwell in a place where eyes can hold fast to his face. Rather, for now, risen from the dead, Jesus dwells in the place where our faith and our hope hold fast, not to his faith, but rather to his promises. Including his promise that he is with us, even if we can't see him, through the presence of the Holy Spirit. And his promise, too, that we will see him, eyes to face, when by grace, through faith, we get to where we're going. The place he has gone before us, Mark says it was to Galilee. Jesus, of course, had come from Galilee, which, to my way of thinking, gets me thinking that where Mark says Jesus has gone before us is back home. And when we get there, when we do at last with our eyes see him, we will know that at long last we are back home too. In the meantime, our news feeds continue to remind us the world is still voting no. Voting no to love, and it seems to me, increasingly in this country anyway, with some of its own mob-crazed, unholy alliances between church and state, voting no to a Jesus who is loving. So what's a Christian to do? Well, here's an idea. Do what Jesus did. Love anyway. Love why? Because the promise, the Easter promise that is holds every single other truly true Easter promise in its hands is the risen from the dead promise that love is what holds forever in its hands. So don't be surprised when the world keeps being the world. Just don't let the world become you. And when the world does and will mock or hate you for loving, love anyway. Because there's no better way to live in this world than to do so standing on the same side as forever. Amen.